Chapter 49. Lysander. Vei Victis. The obsidian prosthetics that Atlas's carver applied to my face itch almost as much as the false beard hanging from my chin. The contacts, however, are black, and my teeth plated gold. Scalps taken from the bridge of the Dustmaker hang from a rope on my belt. They are frozen stiff and clatter against the battered thigh plate of my obsidian armour. My grav bike thrums beside Atlas's over the molten riverlands of Io. A patrol of Volk bikers wave in greeting as they pass in the distance. Atlas waves back. His arms have only recently been reattached. Our three-hour ride from the Leith's hiding place has taxed him a pain price few could pay. But we have arrived at our destination unmolested, clad in the armour of the barbarian host and bearing the digital warrant of the Great Far. Though Far pacified all but Io's toughest strongholds over the last month, while I crossed the gulf with Diomedes, we were still at greater risk from Rim guerrillas than Far's forces during our journey from the Leith. We've come to Plutus to tell Far his anticipated three-year reign over Ilium will be cut short, and to discuss the logistics of his defeat once my fleet arrives. Atlas may have absolute trust in the man, but I'm keenly aware that we will be at Far's mercy. I dread that with every fibre of my being. The battle wall of Demeter's Garter stretches across the horizon. Behind the wall lies a temperate microclimate amidst the hellish landscape of Io. The paradome network, which holds in pressure, oxygen, and filters radiation, steams over it like the surface of a morning winter lake. It bends the light of its artificial suns so that they appear to shine silver. The city of Plutus, the administrative capital of the Garter, is swarmed by Far's divisions. Above the city, two Volk dreadnoughts hover like beasts squatting over their kill. Neither one is Far's flagship. Though we have come to speak to the man, the Pandora is still bombarding Sungrave. We slow our bikes as we approach the battle wall. I watch as, far above, a stream of Proteus transports creeps up toward a swelling orbital caravan. The ships gathering there trickle in from across Io. A coldness creeps into my heart when I realize they carry more than foodstuffs off Io. Diomedes told me slaves are the highest currency to the Ascomani. While the Rim Armada sailed from the core, the Ascomani harvested the populace of Io that could not take refuge in the moon's stronger bastions. The slaves are part of Atlas's sunk cost. Many have been infected with disease and will take that poison back to the ants' nests. A hideous thought. At the battle wall, obsidian and Ascomani bodies are still being pulled from the wreckage of the breach by teams of red slaves bundled thick against the climate. They make frozen heaps with the corpses of raw soldiers. Traffic thickens near the central gate where patrols queue between Cyclope and Statuary to enter the city. When we pass through the gate's pulse field, we are greeted by warmth and elegiac light. The air is breathable, warm, and thick with smoke. The sulphur crystals gathered on my bike and armour join the steam of the other traffic. Beyond the congestion of armoured infantry and war machines driven by blues in strange metal collars, Ascomani overseers crack long whips at red captives. Most labour in the thousands to collect bodies from the paths of destruction, which fan out from the narrow breaches into the orchards and grain fields to either side of Plutus. The Ascomani are taller and lankier than the obsidians, and either umber or grey-skinned. Their hair is coarse, straight, thick, and black. They wear glossy black armour made of onyxia, and bark at each other in an unintelligible savage tongue. They are human, though made less so by their own arcane and perverse use of carvers over the centuries. Some of the cretins are small, like children, with demonic pug faces and surly tempers. the Ascomani are a stain of corruption on the face of paradise. Plutus, a gem in the tiara of the garter, is a garden city where farming is embraced both as a science and a philosophy. An agricultural Eden with warehouses for its crops and academies, arbors and laboratories for its prized brown growers. Public parks, theatres and baths for its droves of red field hands. Limitlessly powered by the tidal heating of the planet, it makes its own weather and its own sunlight, pearly or silver, depending on the crop zone. And for centuries it thrived, invulnerable behind its raw garrison kinetic shields and its elephantine surface-to-orbit cannons. The city mourns the demise of its guardian triad. The shields fell because of Atlas and my Praetorians. Smoke from their sabotage mission still swirls to the west from the ruins of the shield pylons. Bombardment and tides of savages delirious for spoils did in the other two pillars of the city's defences. I follow Atlas as he weaves through traffic toward a road that carries along an orchard of plum trees 5 times larger than those of the core. Ascomani lie together like sated dogs between the trees, gorging on fruit and taunting the greys who've been nailed to the tree trunks. That is not the worst of the carnival of horrors we see before we reach the city, nor indeed the worst we see in the city itself, where an orgy of violence is in full swing. But the look on the face of a young Ionian grey as she watched the braves beneath her eating plums haunts me. Her expression could not be more different from the smile upon the benevolent statue of the goddess Demeter that extends from the harnessed volcano north of the city. We park our bikes in a courtyard, crisscrossed with huge tables hewn from fresh-cut trees. Preparations for a feast are underway, even as an assembly line of Ascomani axemen execute raw greys in the courtyard adjacent. "I'm surprised you didn't have far nuke the garter," I say to Atlas as we ascend the wooden steps to the Arbor of Akari. Like me, his face is concealed by obsidian prosthetics. His nose is horribly bent, his cheeks heavy with scars, and face tattooed with the skull of a stained. "But I suppose even you have your limits?"
"Absent a dependable source of food, there is no civilization," he replies. "The goal is not to destroy the rim, Lysander, but for you to be able to control it without leaving your supper table on the Palatine Hill. Do you want a reign impoverished by infrastructure reconstruction? The garter and the seed vaults were built over dozens of lifetimes. My family might pretend it was the honor in our blood that made us masters beyond the asteroids. In truth, it's the hand that holds the garter that grips the belly of the rim."
"And what if Far decides not to let go of that belly?" I ask. "What if he decides he'd rather be a king than a soldier to a thankless society?"
"A good question. One you should ask him yourself."
I stop and listen to the wailing on the wind. Atop my bike, I could not hear it. Now I can hear nothing else. The city itself is weeping. Atlas turns a few steps up. His voice is gentle.
"Lysander, this is how it has always been. The vaunted past we so revere saw thousands of cities fall to thousands of armies. Periods of trauma are traded for periods of peace. The greater the trauma, the longer the peace. Bear it, and this year will be the last year you see war in your lifetime."
"I will hold you to that," I reply, and march upward. The Arbor of Akari has been spared the murder and rapine that flagellates the rest of the city. Far has taken the building that hosts the Ra's horticultural history for himself and his inner circle. After gaining passage to the arbor's interior, past the blood-painted Askamani warriors who guard its doors, we are greeted by three obsidian veterans in armor studded with gems and encrusted with gold sigils. Beneath apricot and apple trees, Atlas embraces them like long-lost brothers. They are all members of the Kin Shield, the team Farr took with him to aid his rise, and speak fluent common. One by one, Atlas introduces them to me and gives them my true name. They kneel in deference, but I see the confusion in their eyes. They don't know why I am in Ilium. That confusion is shared by the five more Kin Shield Gorgons who return over the course of the next several hours to join us around a circular table set in the arbor's inner sanctum. I am unexpected. That makes me nervous. The Gorgons come with blood on their boots and soot and sulphur on their furs and capes, fresh from supervising the sack of the Garter or the pacification of one of its cities. Stacking their armor beneath a tree, they join us at the table where they drink and laugh with Atlas as if they were back in the barracks on Luna. The conversation is fascinating both in its casual nature and its depth. Very quickly, the signs of Atlas's tutelage become apparent. Their understanding of politics, strategy, and logistics unnerves me, especially when I hear quotes from Cicero, Hobbes, and Seneca used not only in proper context, but sometimes with deft irony. I have never heard such sophisticated conversation from obsidians. That is not all that surprises me. When I ask the Gorgon beside me, a clever-eyed man of 50 or so with a cutlass for a nose and mallets for hands, if he was at Kaliki, he hangs his head for a moment.
"I was," he says.
"Why do you hang your head? Was it not a glorious victory?"
"I find little glory in war," he says. "Satisfaction, yes, for a job well done. I claimed Alexander Aurun upon my blade. He was a worthy foe, and met a worthy end. That was proper. I bested him man to man. But others, great names, Cassander Al Megara, Aletheia Al Kodavan, Talia Al Anthos, I saw them done under by reptiles, spit, skinned. Their warrior virtue, and it was virtue, was denied. That is why I hang my head, Dominus. There is much to admire in our foe and little in our allies."
"Does that dissuade you from your mission?" I ask.
"No, the reptiles cannot help but be reptiles. The Knights of the Rim, however, cannot plead ignorance.
They chose to be traitors to the society that built their world." "You call them reptiles," I say, "like the Moon Lords do."
"They are reptiles, Dominus. Perhaps not in physiology, but in their lack of empathy,"
another answers.
"The centuries have taught them starvation and poverty can only be staved off by violence. They fight other tribes who are their mirror, and so their violence and cruelty are exponential and theatrical."
"It is like they have never seen the light, Dominus,"
rasps a quiet one, whom Atlas seems to favour above the rest. He is lean, handsome in a way, with an eagle's face and clear eyes and a slight lisp.
"Mercy is literally unknown to them. Out there, meat is meat. You understand?"
"No, not yet. Go on. Fergaris, isn't it?" I say.
"Yes, Dominus."
He considers.
"A man from the wilderness who has never heard music might come upon a city and hear through a window the song of a violin. It makes no matter if he knows the complexity of the piece or the reverence culture has for the instrument. He will stop and listen because he can recognize the rarity of beauty. These Askamani would go into the house and beat the player to death for making a racket, enslave the children, break the violin, and burn down the house. All of them. They do not seek context or assimilation. Only domination. If it does not fit into their paradigm, they destroy it.
And what of the Volk? I ask.
The Volk would enjoy the song and listen till its end, then break the man's fingers and steal the violin to sell.
You act as if they're all the same, I say. Are they? Phagaris defers to the others, but they urge him on.
We paint with a broad brush. The Volk have braves who are noble. Some are liars, cheats, and butchers, but some are decent men. Like any army, we all have seen the duality in their nature.
The others nod.
They were raised to worship strength, but unlike the Ascomani, they've tasted the light of culture, of cities, of parks and plays. Yet they feel as if the light has rejected them and spit in their eye. The low colours, the Republic, the Silvers.
The biggest man at the table then adds,
"Far is their catharsis. Their rage on the worlds."
He opens his hands, as if all I do is look out the window.
The Ascomani are simple, Phagaris says. They demand victory, food, and loot, usually human. Managing the Volk takes up the majority of our time. They miss the sun. They are skeptical about Far's claims of making this their new kingdom. Not to mention they are arrogant. They think moons are small potatoes compared with the planets they used to conquer under Tir Morga.
They roll their eyes at each other as if exhausted by that arrogance.
They say secret prayers to the All-Mother, fearing their betrayal of Sephi will bring a terrible judgment upon them all. And worst of all...
He looks at Atlas.
Many wonder if they should ever have left the host of Tir Morga. The Jarls would never dare slander their king, but the braves whisper and pout like guilty children who chose the wrong parents after a divorce.
And how do you combat that? I ask.
A mixture of fear, momentum, loot, division, lies, bribery, public killings, but most important, spectacle and invoking their love of Ragnar Volaris.
I sit back, overwhelmed at the complexity of the army I just assumed was a mindless host. I have also never seen Atlas so warm. What Ajax would have done for half the smile he readily gives any one of these obsidians. But how could Atlas ever respect Ajax, who had everything and gave nothing to the society, when Atlas lived amongst these patriots who have given everything for a society that would give them nothing in return?
"Well said, Goodman," Atlas says. "As you can see, Lysander, the duty I set upon these Gorgons required them to be far more than mere soldiers."
"Far more," I murmur, "and they all get along. For a table of golds like this..."
"We will make you one," Atlas says, and touches my arm. "When we get home, that is our first priority. And what of Volga, my friends? Does the Kinshield have thoughts?"
The men grow quiet.
"Come now, brothers. Young Loon and I have heard your opinions on everyone else."
They are spared from answering when a roar comes from outside. Volsung Fa has returned from Sungrave victorious, and he's apparently brought a dragon. Atlas and I witness Fa's return with his Kinshield from the steps of the arbor. Ensnared by a huge net, the dragon dangles from the belly of the Pandora. Its scales are iridescent black and purple. Its wings nearly translucent. It thrashes against the net in vain and lets out a mournful howl. It feels to me as if it is calling to its masters or its children. It sounds like it is weeping. Fard descends from his flagship upon a giant floating altar loaded with chained gold captives. Not one of the bloodied, chained peerless draw the eyes more than the king sitting on his throne in his black spiked armour with his unshorn honour tail and his gold crown. The crown grows in size with every victory. Purportedly, when Askermani shaman tear the sigils from the hands of his gold captives, they melt them onto the crown, or into his throne, or even the altar itself. A figure stands to the right of Far's throne throughout this performance, a shorter obsidian woman, one of the only women I've yet seen in Far's host. Atlas informs me this is the object of the question that silenced Far's friends. Volga, the biological daughter of Ragnar Volaris, newly acquired from Mars. What must she make of all this? I wonder. Far's affection for her is plain, and I watch the two with interest until I spot three girls who are spared the violation of having their sigils scalped like the others. They are all women, one old, one of middling age, and one a young girl. They are kept on leashes by Far's bodyguards. A cloud settles over Atlas when he sees them, one that deepens when the procession takes on spiritual overtones and the dragon is brought down from the Pandora to be butchered by Far. Using his barbaric weapon, a great saw, he climbs atop the dragon and excises its man-sized heart. He lifts that mass over his head and casts it into a bonfire. Then the dragon is butchered, roasted, and fed to the braves. Spectacle, they said. As the feast rages beneath, Far meets us in his stateroom aboard the Pandora. I am shocked by the change of his appearance. He has traded his armour, his entourage of Askermani and Volk Jarls, and the facade of a barbarian king, for a beautiful purple silk kimono, bandages, and a glass of cognac. The glass is tiny and would be hilarious in his huge hands, if not for his terrifying stature and appearance. It is no wonder the grimaces once used this man as a stud bull. He is the pinnacle of obsidian genetics, gargantuan in size, but ropey with usable muscle, like an albino python. Nearly two heads taller than I am, with scars in shapes I've never seen before. One of his hands is metal, with clawed fingers that he wears little caps on. His jaw is made entirely of metal, too. A terrible burn has claimed one of his eyes, and the eye replaced with a tech mod. He sets his cognac down on a jade table delicately. He takes in Atlas's obsidian face with a smile. His voice is the deepest I've ever heard.
Allfather, you look positively barbarous.
They laugh and embrace. Atlas pulls back to hold the man's giant head between his hands.
A brilliant show, old friend. You are the pride of Koor Nihil. Your brothers and sisters send their compliments. They miss you and the Kinshield dearly. You should hear them chant you on.
And I miss them more than I can say. The Kinshield is always so busy putting out fires. Housed just shy of a million and not one genteel conversation to be had.
When they part, they clap each other on the shoulders and laugh. Atlas notes Far's many bandages.
You're wounded. Do you need any antitoxins?
Not like on Mars. Surface pestilence was itchy. These wounds are not grievous. My armor is thick for a reason. Sungrave is broken, of course, as you commanded. The Eskimani are loading what remains of its populace onto transports. In 3 days, the city will be at Tum.
Well done indeed. But really, will you take that out? You sound insane.
Fart detaches a device from his throat and sets it on the table.
Ah, that's better. Hard to enunciate with that baritone.
The warlord's natural voice is shockingly soft and sensitive. He's a fraud. A consummate fraud. The only thing not fraudulent is his physical menace, which I think is actually enhanced by his obvious cleverness. Farr's eyes finally wander to me, curious and sparkling with intelligence.
Your bodyguard is not obsidian, either.
How can you tell? I ask.
Obsidians don't lean in doorways,
he replies, and nods to my shoulder against the doorframe.
Bad luck.
I stand straight and file that away.
I am not his bodyguard, at any rate. I am Lysander Auloon, I reply. Are you? Are you really?
Farr asks. Very intrigued. He squints at my obsidian prosthetics, dubious, then laughs in delight.
So you are. Xanthus has outdone herself yet again.
Farr bows, but does not kneel.
Dominus Loon, an honour to meet one of the blood.
He raises an eyebrow at Atlas.
Am I to understand there has been a change of plans regarding the beneficiary of this endeavour, then? He smirks. Or has the new loon come to banish us like the last loon?
The former, Atlas says. The three of us have much to discuss, but first I must see my kin.
I trail the two men through the brig until they come to the void cell containing Atlas's sister. Its occupant can neither see nor hear us. Vela is a hard-faced veteran with even less charisma than Romulus and more fire than Atlas. She lies on her bed without moving.
You broke her back, Atlas notes.
Farr gestures to several of his bandages.
For my trouble. It was the only way, I fear, to take a warrior like her alive in a pitched fray. Very difficult. Apologies. Diomedes was meant to be a sure thing.
Atlas glances at me.
We scoured the battlefield and the escape pods as thoroughly as we could. My kinshield believe he was likely vaporized in a blast. Per your recommendation, I was liberal with the grimace atomics you supplied. If I had known we would need to search for a survivor...
I don't blame you, Fagnar.
Insists on using Farr's original name, a sign of friendship. Then he shoots a look of annoyance back at me to show Farr who he does blame.
Vela will do, Farr asks, even with a broken back?
She will, Atlas says. I need her nervous system, not her spine.
And what exactly do you need her for? I ask.
He doesn't know, Farr asks. Not everything. Not yet, Atlas says.
You said you'd be fully transparent, I say. I've thrown in with you at the cost of my soul. What could you possibly think you need to hold back?
What's a soul to an atheist?
Atlas asks Farr. Farr makes a farting sound.
Gas.
Atlas smiles and moves on to the middle cell. I'm about to press the issue, but Atlas preempts my question.
Just a moment, lad. All of my cards will be on the table in short order.
Atlas trails off as he approaches the cell of his mother. Gaia, the old matron of House Ra, is a broken woman. Her vacant eyes stare at the grey wall of her cell as she murmurs a phrase I can't quite make out. Atlas watches her for a few moments, his emotions inscrutable.
My nieces, nephews, did my mother see it done?
Farr hesitates.
She cut their throats with her own hand, but she could not bring herself to kill the youngest. Atlas's eyes soften for his mother. For a moment he looks like he will cry. Instead, he turns his attention to the last gold prisoner, a girl still shy of puberty with red-rimmed eyes and the long face of the Ra. Thalia, Diomedes's younger sister.
Neither could you, it seems, Atlas says. She looks like you, and she bit me very hard.
She does look like Atlas. Her face is slender, her eyes narrow and quiet, and has the same distant boredom so commonly seen in Atlas's expression.
You were not so soft before Volga joined us. Was she there with you?
Atlas asks. Farg grimaces.
She was.
I thought you might need a bargaining.
Have I ever minced words with what I do and do not need, old friend?
I will kill the girl now, then.
Far moves to open the cell.
No,
I say.
Atlas turns and lifts an eyebrow. Knowing only proving her utility will spare the girl, I conjure some from the ether.
The Rim is stubborn and proud. Many will resent me as sovereign, even if I am their savior.
But if I were to wed to an ancestor of Akari, then might not that ease the pill down? Atlas's eyes narrow.
It will be years before she's of age.
I thought you were a man who planned for the future. Seems a waste to trim this possible future from our tree. No? Better to have the option.
You more than anyone should know the perils of mercy, Atlas says. More than anyone except Darrow, perhaps.
The difference is, I watched Darrow cut down Octavia. Thalia has only seen him.
I dip my head in Far's direction.
Atlas smiles softly.
We'll consider it.
He waves Far away from the cell.
Come, we have plans to iron out.
I linger as the two men make their way from the brig. Thalia is older than I was when my parents died, younger than I was when Darrow killed Octavia. It wakes my sympathy. If I keep her alive, perhaps I've paid some of my debt back to Diomedes.
Gaia is another matter now. When last I saw her, she hid her cunning behind a guise of senility, but grief has broken the woman. She whispers the same phrase over and over, the same phrase a barbarian murmured to a Roman declaiming the price of surrender long ago. Vae victis, woe to the vanquished.